Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So a warm welcome to eHealth Learning. My name's Julian Marcus. I'm here with Steve Haynes today. It's Monday the 6th of July. And this is a webinar that we've entitled Pain Revolution, a new paradigm for working with persistent pain. Steve's been on our platform before. He did a webinar a year or so ago, didn't you? Steve's a craniosacral therapist and chiropractor and has been working in healthcare for over 25 years as a body worker since 1998. And he's the co-author of Cranial Intelligence and author of three other books, Pain is Really Strange, Trauma is Really Strange, and most recently, Anxiety is Really Strange. Is that right, Steve?
Yep, correct.
And that one won an award. Understanding the science of pain and trauma has transformed his approach to healing. He studied yoga, shiatsu, biodynamic craniosacral therapy, and TRE, trauma releasing exercises. And Steve is registered as a chiropractor and in the UK and teaches TRE and cranial work all over the world. His treatments now use education, embodied awareness, and light touch to help people move more freely and be more present. And Steve works and lives between London and Geneva. So a warm welcome, Steve. And this is a introduction and open first part to a three-part series that you're going to be offering at the same time from next week, which is open for enrollment. And the links are in Facebook, and they're also on embodiedhealthlearning.com. If you go to courses, you'll see Steve's course there, Pain Revolution, starting on the 13th of July next week at 10:30 UK time. So is there anything you wanted to add before you share your slides? You've got some slides for us.
That's good, thanks.
Wonderful. So thank you everyone for coming, and I'll hand you over to Steve, and I'll be here to support any questions. Put your questions in the chat box. We'll be about an hour in time, and there'll be pauses where I can bring some of the questions, if relevant, to that section of the webinar to Steve, and we can address some of the further questions at the end if there are any then. Lovely. Thank you.
Good. Welcome, folks. My name's Steve Haynes. I love pain. I kind of don't love pain in a sadomasochistic way. I love pain because I think there's a lot that we can do. And I think the current science has really transformed our understanding of how pain works. And it's a much more complex phenomena. But in that complexity lies lots of possibility for growth and change. A pain revolution, I think. That term was, the back pain revolution was used by a writer, Gordon Waddell, in the 1990s. And he started off this idea that pain is not just about structural issues. Well, he was one of the first big writers around that. There are strands of the complexity of pain in earlier writing. But that phrase, the back pain revolution, was a very influential book in the 90s. And the science has grown and grown and grown. Pain is a complex perception. That's going to be one of the themes in the workshops that we're going to explore. When we're dealing with revolutions, or let's use another term, a paradigm shift, it's hard. Old beliefs take a long time to die out. We're going to look at old philosophical ways of approaching pain, going all the way back to Aristotle, to look at his version of how pain is the opposite of pleasure. And that's quite different from maybe the philosophy that's governed modern medicine, that pain is a linear experience. And that maybe we can trace that idea typically back to Descartes 400 years ago, is often sort of blamed or is often held responsible for this separation of mind and body and this notion that there are fixed linear events that are independent of personhood, actually, and the complexity of being a person. So yeah, a big paradigm shift. If some of this doesn't make sense, that's fine. That's the way with paradigm shifts. You need to chew on it, play with it, explore it in your own experience, try new ways of explaining things and new metaphors to use with your clients. I'm going to give you a heads up of some of the big things that I'll be exploring in the other three workshops. And you know, there's some really good stuff here today that should hopefully help stimulate you and kind of appreciate pain might not be what you think it is, a much richer, more complex experience. Good. I'm going to do a screen share and just show you some slides. So this is a sort of overview. I'm going to move this up a little bit. This is the overview of the four sections we're going to be talking about today. So pain is a perception. We'll look at some pain definitions and pain models. We're going to explore tell me your story, metaphors for pain and how they're important. And we'll explore a couple of new metaphors maybe for you, different ways of sort of explaining pain. And very quickly at the end, we'll just look at some general principles to change pain. Those will be things I expand on much more in the three lecture series. This is me. I wrote some comic books. This was the first one. It's very dear to my heart. They've done well, sort of over 20,000 sold for the pain one, and lots of nice reviews on Amazon and around. The idea is a short and sweet introduction to complex subject, but trying to make it much more accessible. So if you want to find out more about how I think, this is a good place to start. First up, is there a problem? Absolutely. There is a devastating problem of pain in our world. One in five people in persistent pain is from a number of studies, large studies. The top one here from 2006, they sampled over 200,000 people in 15 European countries. That's a really big study. And they found one in five people in persistent pain states. And the majority of people were in moderate to severe pain more than 6 months. And actually the median time was a number of years. I think it was 6-7 years. So that's a huge, huge amount of people living in persistent pain. And other studies, same figures, if America-centric or different parts of the world. In Europe, the prevalence of chronic pain is 25 to 30%. So they're going even higher, one in four people in persistent pain. We are in the middle of a pain epidemic. There's no doubt about that. Unfortunately, we don't know how to treat it. And some of the strategies for treating are really, really damaging for people. So there may be all sorts of complex reasons why opioids are prescribed for pain. And as a sort of short-term option, they can be useful, but generally it's really not seen as best practice. Certainly 10, 15 years ago, maybe a big push by pharma to promote strong painkillers based on opioids. Kind of natural heroin supplies, if you like. And the consequences of these decisions made are horrifying. So 67,000 people died from drug overdoses in 2018 related to opioid use, and 70% of those were prescription or illicit opioids. That's not a heroin, that's like illegal versions of prescription drugs. To people to maintain or feed their habit that developed from prescription drugs. And it causes a huge amount of deaths. This is not a small amount of people dying here. And unfortunately, it's not just the United States. Australia has failed to heed the lessons of the United States and is now facing skyrocketing rates of opioid prescriptions and related deaths. This is from an article in Australia 2019. And the crime here is that we know current guidelines are really that doctors should be very careful about prescribing opioids. But still, this is a study from Sweden in 2020, this is February this year, more than half the incident opioid dispensations to patients within the first year after knee or hip osteoarthritis diagnosis are inappropriate according to current treatment guidelines. So good science knows that giving out opioids isn't best practice, but it still happens in modern European countries and all over the world. People are given opioids far too quickly by doctors who really should know better. So huge problems, how we treat pain and the amount of incidents of pain. So let's just have a short break. Julian, how's the speed? Any questions? Please do use the chat feature. Julian will be looking at it every so often. Let me know if it's making sense, if you have any more questions. And I'll try to go slowly. I have a habit of going really quickly when I get excited, so I'll slow down a little bit.
I like the excitement and the importance of this pain perception and pain approaches. So I was thinking you could go a tiny bit slower, but I think it's I like your insight. But
yeah, no problem. Good. Okay, well, if there's no questions, I'm going to move on and we'll take another pause in 5-10 minutes.
Sure.
So let's start with this notion that pain is a perception. This is one of the philosophical shifts to understand pain isn't a linear event, but it's a complex thing happening inside a person, and that person is inside their world. Pain happens to people, and people are irreducibly complex. There's many, many things affecting what happens inside of a person and how they perceive the context and the environment are really important things. Here's one of my heroes in philosophy, Merleau-Ponty. He's a phenomenologist, writes about the importance of the body and how consciousness is deeply related to how we exist in a body and move our body and interact and engage with the world through our body. If we're a body worker, Merleau-Ponty is gold dust, I think. So let's quote him on pain. This is writing in the 1940s and 50s, probably. If pain is essentially part of my perception and my point of view changes, the quality of the pain must also change. What I advocate is an insight into our bodily capacity to change our body's pain by means of a change of perception. So I want us to think about squinting slightly differently, tilting our head to get a different viewpoint around pain. We're going to approach it in a different way to maybe some of the common themes in our culture or the common themes in our families or our faith. And by this change of perspective, this change of perception, we might have another way of working with and understanding our pain. And this is really in line with the current science. Let's look at perception and the fact that we can't always trust what we are perceiving. So these two orange dots are the same size. Your brain's screaming at you, that's wrong, but they really are the same size. But the context around them, the big dots and the small dots, fool your brain into making an erroneous decision or an erroneous perception here. Brains can get it wrong. Here's another really great perceptual challenge. So all the horizontal lines here are straight. They look incredibly wonky, but all the extra little bits of information are straight. All the extra little bit of information are fooling our brain. So I didn't believe this, so I drew some lines, and then I imposed the lines over the picture, and you can see that they are straight, even though it's still quite a challenge. Let's go back to the original. Wow, that's just a phenomenal visual illusion. So what's happening inside of us, the context around us, is really important to our pain experience. This is a great pain, strange pain story. And it's quoted by one of the heroes of pain, Patrick Wall. He was very influential, came up with the gate concept of theory, a gate concept of pain, pain gate theory in the 1960s. And this is kind of a classic book, Pain, the Science of Suffering. He was actually in persistent pain at the end of his life from cancer. It's a really wonderful book. So he tells this story about Amir bin Wid. This is the guy, and you can see his leg's been cut off. This sword is still in the museum in Istanbul. I've actually seen the double-ended sword. So Abu bin Wid threw his amputated leg at Imam Ali. Now, I'd have thought most of us would assume that if our leg was cut off, we'd be writhing in agony and we wouldn't be able to do much else. But there was a different priority here for Amir bin Wid. He was protecting his homeland, his family, his life, his culture. And he just kept fighting to the point where he picked up his own leg and threw it at his attacker. That is quite phenomenal. His brain had a different perception. His own personal integrity was less important. Bodily integrity was less important than carrying on fighting. Quite incredible story. But this has actually been borne out consistently by people returning from battlefields. They'll walk off the battlefield, they'll say they had a bump, hand or a knock or something, an innocuous sensation, and then they'll realize they're missing a hand or a limb or part of their body has gone. Quite incredible, consistent evidence from soldiers in war zones. Keep breathing. This guy was in a ski accident. So, ski instructor impales face on 18-inch tree branch and shares gruesome photos from hospital bed. He was skiing through some trees, enjoying himself, a fresh powder day, I think, in the original newspaper article. Went through some trees and boom, he got this branch stuck in his head, stuck in his lip. And here's how he described this process. I love this photo. He looks a little bit like Jesus here, I think, quite a religious quality to it. I thought maybe my chin strap got pushed up into my face, so I tried to brush it off, and that's when I felt the stick. Holy crap, I just got impaled, Hargood said. And then I yelled over to Pete, hey, look, I got a new piercing. This rough, tough skier who skied down the mountain with this in his face said, the most painful part of the experience was the numbing shots from the hospital. That's quite incredible, isn't it, really? To go through a massive amount of tissue damage, and not really feel any pain and still be able to move and get help. I really want you to keep breathing on this one. This is, I looked up voluntary piercings once and religion on the internet. I really would not recommend it. People do some crazy things. Here's someone who's voluntarily pierced themselves. So this is part of a religious or paradigm. And let's go back because that's a bit too much. So the voluntary piercings, it's known that people, when they choose to do that and they're in a state of religious ecstasy, have less blood flow, they heal quicker and have less pain from the experience. The context, the meaning around the event changes the actual experience of the event. It's a perception, and perception is deeply malleable to the context and other things going on inside our nervous system. Here's one more, kind of slightly more classic example from pain and x-rays. So for a long time, when x-rays first came in, and MRI imaging, they would only image people who were in pain or had accidents. And here we can see, if there's any chiropractors or osteopaths out there or doctors, this is a massive dislocation of the neck. I mean, that is really scary. This person's lucky to be alive. These vertebrae should all be aligned like this. And C4's slid massively forward on C5. And it's pressing on his spinal cord, causing all sorts of problems here. This was a 22-year-old man who came to the hospital after having 10 days of neck pain. However, 2 months before, he'd been pain-free for 2 months. He'd fallen from a standing height from a ladder, but he did not have any pain, weakness, or paresthesia with this massive dislocation. So for 2 months, he was walking around with this in his neck. Then he had a bit of neck pain for 10 days. And this is what the x-ray showed. So massive tissue damage and no pain. And this is actually really, really common. People have horrible x-rays. And when you look at the x-ray, they have, when you ask them about their pain, they have no pain. And the converse is true. People have very clean x-rays and they can have horrible pain. So you cannot predict pain from looking at an MRI scan or looking at x-rays. That's really important to understand. Initially, because these are expensive imaging, they only image people who were in pain. But then they started doing long-term studies and imaging the general population, and they found the same changes in the normal population. They found the same changes they were blaming on causing pain in people without pain. So we should be incredibly careful of this linear model that what we can see, that tissue damage, the shape of your spine, the position of joints, is sufficient or necessary to cause persistent pain. Let's take a little break here. Any questions coming through? Any thoughts? Anything to summarize, Julian?
There's nothing through on questions. Can you say, there's one right now. Can you say why you find it too much to see an image of sacred ritual piercings?
Because I've seen pictures of 20, 30 knives in someone's cheek or huge amounts of things hanging off their body. For me personally, I just find that quite distressing. So I really wouldn't recommend looking at religious piercings, but you know, you're free to choose. Okay. So hopefully the pace is okay. I'm going to move on a little bit and just sort of look at some pain definitions and some models. So let's go all the way back to the root of European thought. Greek philosophy was very, very influential in European thought. So Aristotle, we measure our actions by the rule of pleasure and pain. Pain is not one of the five senses, but is a passion of the soul. All the way back at the root of European thought is this understanding that pain is a complex experience. It's a passion of the soul. It's not like hearing or seeing or tasting or touching. We've learned all those five classic senses are much more complex, but always it's seen as a meta-level human experience, a passion of the soul. Pain is the opposite of pleasure. And I find that really interesting, that we have this complexity and celebration of complexity at the root of our philosophical thought. However, we changed. We started getting better at looking at precision and looking at detail, and that kind of blinded us a little bit for decades, actually, in centuries. We started looking at much more linear models and the body as a machine. Descartes' actual framing of the body as a machine was really much more exciting than how we conceive of machines right now. For Descartes, machines were like new science. They were these magical things that expressed sort of agency and sort of independent action almost. So his use of the metaphor of a machine-like quality for the body was actually quite rich and did imply some notion of internal agency and internal self-organization. That meaning, we've lost that now when we talk about machines. Here's a famous image from Descartes of the boy putting his toe in the fire, and that generates what he conceived of as a pulley system that rang a little bell in the brain. And this model of a fixed input, if I stand on your big toe, you get a consistent signal that's pretty measurable and knowable and leads to a predictable amount of pain. A little bit like if we all hear the same noise, we'd probably grade it pretty roughly as a loud noise, an unpleasant noise, or a quiet noise with a little bit of variation. But that linear experience, pain is an input into the system rather than the Aristotle model. It's an output and a complex perception. This model, this philosophical shift into pain as an input and a linear experience has been deeply influential for 100 years. It's why doctors can look at an x-ray, say that you must be in pain because you've got something out of line. I'm going to fix you by operating on your knee or the joint to clean up the joint, to straighten the joint, to correct the thing that's missing, and that's going to reduce your pain. That's a linear model, and unfortunately, it has not stood the test of time. Current science and current investigations absolutely unequivocally show that the structure is not enough or necessary for persistent pain. So let's look at some definitions of pain. So here's a nice one. Pain is a subjective experience that protects the body. It's all about you and what's happening inside you, all the things that affect your ability to perceive, your subjectivity. It's not an objective fixed input, it's an output. This is another really lovely book on pain. Fernando Severo was the head of the International Association for the Study of Pain. They are a very, very influential organization around best standards around pain and research around pain. And he says in his book, it is very hard to measure pain. In fact, he states, Pain is a complex experience that can only be measured by the verbal report of patients. Let's think about that. If someone says they're in pain, they're in pain. We should really honor that because we can't objectively measure it. You can't look at one part of the brain and measure the amount of activity in that part of the brain and expect to work out how much pain they're in. The whole of a person's brain will light up when they're in pain. All sorts of areas get involved: memory, emotion, thoughts, old reflexes. There's a whole mishmash of stuff going on. So we don't have a pain center, we don't have pain pathways, and we don't have pain receptors. We have a complex perceptual experience. We cannot measure pain, but you can only measure it by the verbal report of patients from a really influential body and the head of that body, who was chair of the association for a number of years. Here's the definition that I really like. Pain is at a fundamental level all about your brain's assessment of safety. Unsafe things hurt. If your brain thinks you're safe, pain goes down. Pain, there's an intentional stance here we can use. The purpose of pain is to tell you something's dangerous, something that you're potentially or actually damaging your tissues. So I want us to think about pain as a warning sign that emerges when there's a perception of danger. So a lack of safety leads to responses to protect, and a noisy warning signal, pain, is a reflex to protect us. There's other reflexes: fight or flight, the mobilizing response, immobilizing and dissociating. We also chain our immune system. Most inflammatory responses we can absolutely categorize as protective reflexes. So pain, inflammation, the stress response, fight or flight, and dissociation and immobilizing are all outputs to protect in response to feeling unsafe. And this definition, at the heart of it, also holds a clue about how we need to treat and work with pain. If your brain thinks you're safe, pain goes down. Anything that promotes us feeling safe, safe to move, safe to feel, helps us turn down the volume on our noisy alarm system that's habitually creating alarm signal, but maybe is out of sync with the actual state of the tissue. Good. So this attempt to honor the complexity has led some very nice writing. This is a model from the 1970s called the biopsychosocial model of health. And it says that all these things, biology, psychology, and social experience, are relevant to our pain experience. Biology might include the classic thing of tissue pathology or excess load on the tissues. There's something wrong with the structure. Your back is out of line, your joint is arthritic, you've strained a muscle. These are tissue pathologies. These are not irrelevant. They are important to the pain experience, but they are nowhere near enough to cause the majority of persistent pain. They're one of many things that can contribute. But these is what we focused on as a pain specialist, as masseurs, chiropractors, osteopaths, doctors, surgeons. This has been the focus for decades, and it turns out to be a small part of the picture. We've blamed nociception, so pain signals. We've blamed inflammation. These things are important. The biology does contribute to the pain experience. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. There are some genetic conditions that do predispose you to have more pain. However, at least as important is the psychology and the social situation. Your beliefs, your thoughts, your knowledge, what you're predicting, your emotions and feelings, and how you move and act in the world, your psychology, all of these things make a huge contribution. So if you believe that you're a broken machine and you're permanently damaged, then those psychological experiences predict that you will be stuck in persistent pain regardless of the state of your tissues. So how you construct your pain experience, I'm in pain because I'm old. This is actually not true. There's one thing that we can guarantee about you getting old, and that's you're going to die. The rest of it is negotiable and up for grabs. So your peak incidence of back pain and neck pain will be in your 30s to 40s on average. When you're over 50, your incidence of back pain and neck pain goes down. This is very robust long-term data. I might offer here, my interpretation of that is most people in their 30s and 40s are still trying to do what they thought they could do in their 20s and haven't adapted. They don't factor in the recovery time, and their egos are getting in the way a little bit, and they're pushing their bodies a little bit too hard. We can still do amazing things, but we need to recover a little bit more as we get older. I think over 50 people maybe have learnt that a little bit more. And this notion that we need to adapt and not try and be a 20-year-old all the time may be one of the reasons why we're a bit wiser, we use our body a bit more carefully. Remember, we can still do incredible things. I collect stories around marathon runners in their hundreds and people who can do headstands in their 90. But we might need to be a little bit more focused on recovery rather than just thinking we're as robust as we were in our 20s. But please do not fall into the trap of believing that pain is an inevitable consequence of old age. You do not have pain because you are old. Unequivocally. Let's look at some of the social factors. The people around you, your friends, the colleagues, the community, your culture, your faith, all have a huge influence on your pain experience. I always like to think of one of my clients here. She was a successful author in her 50s, and she came with a shoulder problem that worked, that changed pretty quickly, and then we met her back problem. She'd be given the gift of osteopathy when she was 13 because her mother had back pain and her grandmother had back pain. The women in our family have back pain. So let's make sure that you don't get back pain by giving you loads of treatments as a teenager. Those treatments actually scared her about her back. They made her think her back was vulnerable. We explored deconstructing that belief, realizing that you're not your mother, you're not your grandmother, that you can move and don't need to have this downward pressure and fear, this message of being unsafe, that women in our family have bad backs. And so absolutely what the context, the meanings in your family, your culture, your friends will absolutely affect your experience of pain. I also want to add in another element and to really appreciate power endowment, power dynamics in society and culture. It's very, very clear you will be more stressed, you're more likely to have poorer health if you're poor, if you're disenfranchised, if you're experiencing racism, sexism, disableism, issues around gender. All of those things absolutely will increase your stress response and lead you to predict you to having more pain. Let's look at some data around that. Well, some data, some researchers who described this. Health gets worse every step down the social ladder, so that the poor are less healthy than those in the middle, who are in turn less healthy than those further up. Beautiful book from 2009. Let's look at a study or information from the Center for Disease Control, a huge government body. You're probably hearing a lot about them in the COVID crisis. So research in 2016, they're reinforcing this huge incidence of pain. One in five people in the US adults have chronic pain. They have this subset of high impact chronic pain. So almost one in 10 people with even more severe chronic pain. They found that chronic pain is more prevalent among adults living in poverty, adults with less than high school education, and adults with public health insurance rather than private health insurance. All these markers of poverty and injustice are predictors, very strong predictors of you being in more pain. We cannot separate pain from people and how people are held in the wider dynamics of justice and society. Really, really important to understand that. Uh, another study, 2018, Pain and the Social Self. They're really highlighting research that talks about pain as a social experience. Pain is inherently a social experience, these researchers offer, and threatens our social needs in three fundamental ways. Pain matters because it shifts our control away from the person with pain. I'm less powerful. I can do less in my world. I have to rely on others. That creates more stress and predicts worse outcomes. It excludes me from doing things. The depression and stress I feel because I can't do things becomes a huge factor in me trusting my body and feeling safe. And pain is often associated with perceived or actual and real injustice. These things, these stories about how we feel and how safe we feel, not just in our homes, not just inside our body, but inside our culture, are really important to understand. And this has big consequences because these social needs are often considered secondary to physical health needs. Doctors will only focus on MRI scans, structure, and medication typically, without having the skills or training or even the paradigm that our social needs are really important to address to help people come out of pain. Let's take a pause there because there's some big chewy things in there. Let me go back to this diagram, the biopsychosocial model of pain. And welcome to any questions or reflections.
There are a few. There's some on Facebook as well. If you're watching this live on Facebook, Alyssa and Irish and some others have put some questions there. Feel free to place your questions in the chat box below the live stream or in the chat here in Zoom. So we have one in the Q&A also in Zoom. Do you believe the source of physical pain can be entirely emotional when there is no history of physical injury?
I'm going to back off a little bit and just explore the language here, because we're already doing a Descartesian split by saying there's physical pain is different from emotional pain. I'm offering that pain is always about the person. So I don't teach there's different levels. I don't teach physical pain is different from emotional pain, is different from spiritual pain, is different from mental pain. When I use the word pain, I want you to think of the word suffering. A person suffers, not a body part. So directly equivalent, for me, the two terms, emotional and physical pain, there is a person who is overloaded and they're presenting that as a bodily experience. Their distress, their suffering is being represented somewhere in the body.
Great. Yeah, even more questions popping up. People are seriously engaged. This is awesome. Very interesting. I can see the source of so much fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, etc. in this, she's saying, one lady.
Really celebrate that. One of the nice insights, and this is something we'll explore in the second lecture of the series about the nervous system and the immune responses, is it's really powerful to understand inflammation is an output to protect us, just like the warning signal of pain. Just as our nervous system gets habitual and it keeps overprotecting us and makes pain as a noisy alarm signal consistently, our inflammatory systems are ongoingly overprotecting us. Inflammation is a very powerful tool, a little bit like cooking and turning on the fire to cook some food. We can cook more interesting food with heat. However, if we leave the heat out of control, it's going to start destroying the food and maybe even start burning down the house. And persistent inflammatory responses that are turned up too high can run out of control and lead to all sorts of systemic problems. So absolutely, we can really make strong parallels with this model. If we help people feel safe, we'll turn down the pain signal, but we'll also turn down the overactive inflammatory responses.
Awesome. So another one, I don't know how many of these we can get to in this pause, but
a couple more.
Okay, so how do you view being persistently in fight, flight contributing to pain? Constant tension in muscles and structures due to being in the ready, steady, go mode, as I totally agree that the physiological sense of safety is totally important in overall health.
Yeah, well, If there's a danger signal from somewhere, we turn on these parallel outputs. That's the important thing. They're all happening at the same time. My brain is creating a noisy alarm signal. I'm going to call that pain. It's also gearing me up to run quickly or tighten big muscles or changing my breathing, increasing my heart rate. There's more stress hormones, more danger chemicals. My fluid chemical soup is sensitized and full of danger messages. All of those things get conflated. But it is quite useful, I think, to see the stress response as a parallel output to the pain response. They don't, you know, one doesn't create the other. They're both happening at the same time as the brain tries to protect us and generate strategies, speeding up or noisy alarm signal to help us survive the perception of threat.
So I'll take one more question from Facebook then, and I'll try to go back in order because there's a few there also. Sadly, on Facebook, sometimes the posts disappear. So there's one here. Why are more women diagnosed with chronic pain syndromes? And is it correct to lump pain into one category? So you've kind of answered that, that you don't see it as levels and different.
There are some gender differences, certainly around inflammation. So a lot of autoimmune conditions which are rooted in inflammation do have a strong gender bias. So women are more likely to get autoimmune diseases. I don't really know why there might be more people in more women in persistent pain. So I haven't got a really good answer why there is, other than we know that there is a higher disposition for autoimmune inflammatory, overactive inflammatory responses sometimes. So I haven't got a clear answer about why there's more women in persistent pain. Sure. We might say, if we're looking at social status, one element though might be that women are traditionally have less power in our culture and more subject to abuses of power. And that might be something to investigate, but I really don't know any data to support that claim.
Could there be a difference, Steve, in bodily awareness and felt sense differences with, you know, the stereotype that men are more in their head, like the guy in war who's lost his leg and then throws it at him. If we're more disconnected to physical sensation in the body for more of a aptitude towards, or
One of the teachings I would offer is getting good at the feeling business and being more in tune with feelings is a really good strategy. However, typically women are better than that at men, so that would lead to, you'd offer, if that argument was true, we might think there'd be slightly less women in pain. So I don't know, but absolutely one of the strategies I will offer is that being attuned to your body, being embodied and learning to regulate feelings and not go down catastrophic predictions in response to those feelings is a very useful skill and really helps people come out of pain.
Definitely.
Okay, so much to talk about. I'm going to move on a little bit and just look at storytelling and metaphors. So tell me your story. This is the strategy. If pain is a complex perception, let's look at how we can reframe our story, reframe our perception. So first up, here's a line from Joanna Burke. Again, one of my favorite books on pain, a philosophical and historical explanation of pain. She's where I learned to equate suffering and pain. I use the terms pain and suffering interchangeably. If you just think there's physical pain and emotional pain is something different, you're doing the Cartesian split. And that might be something, you know, that's a philosophical shift that I don't think is that useful when we're working with pain and is not where the current science is pointing us. It's much more complex than an event in the tissues in the body. Some of the heroes of pain are Lorimer Moseley and David Butler. They came up with the explain pain paradigm. They have this framework that all pain descriptors are metaphors. Remember the head of the IASP saying that you can't measure pain, you can only rely on the verbal report of patients. So we use descriptors. We say pain is like something. It's like a stabbing. It's like a burning. That's how we explain our pain experience. We use the metaphors and language from our culture, from our family, to describe our experience of pain. It's one of the reasons why pain changes or has different words and experiences and presentations in different cultures. Classic example of that actually is whiplash. In the America and the UK, there's a massive whiplash culture because you would get financial gain from insurers if you were having persistent pain from whiplash. So there was a cultural stereotype that it was actually you could earn money from getting whiplash. Countries that don't have that had a much smaller pain experience. They had less dramatic metaphors. There was none of this perceived benefit of a whiplash. So people had a different descriptors and different experience. They had less pain after whiplash. Amazing, amazing stuff. I'm going to offer one of my favorite metaphors. Pain, persistent pain is like an alarm system gone wrong. Our goal is to not change the tissues. Our goal is to turn down the alarm system. I grew up in the 1980s, and we had got told at some stage to have a smoke detector in our house. My dad hated that smoke detector. The goal of the smoke detector was to protect us all if the house was burning down. However, every time we burnt the toast, that smoke detector would go off. So we just used to bang on it with the broom handle, and we never had a smoke detector that worked in our house. So that's how what happens in persistent pain. There's an innocuous signal that reminds you of this really dangerous event. Maybe you did fall over 5 years ago and you twisted your knee bite quite badly. However, your knee is sensitized. Your alarm system is too sensitized. Every time you move that knee when you walk or run up some stairs, it's like burning the toast, and it creates exactly the same noisy signal as if the house was burning down, as if there was real damage. Pain is like an alarm system gone wrong. It's an habitual response that's out of relationship with the actual tissue damage. Another metaphor is like it's a computer and keyboard processor that have gone wrong. This is called central sensitization. Normally, when you type in XXX, you get XXX as the output. When we're sensitized, when our alarm system, our computer, our processing is not working well, when you're sensitized, you can type XXX and you get a whole jumble and mishmash of noisy, damaging signals. The problem here is that where control systems are overreacting and are not producing accurate representations of what's happening in the tissues. I'm going to use another metaphor. I'm going to give just these three, really. An alarm system gone wrong, being sensitized, a computer that's not working and processing correctly. And here we're going to use a fire that's burning out of control. I like this one. This is from a really great pain blogger called Greg Lehman. He's really feisty and very opinionated, but he's a really, really great pain educator. So he came up with this metaphor. Biomechanics are to pain as kindling is to fire. So biomechanics, the state of your tissue, the structure of your body, the thing that was historically seen as the most important contributor to pain. If you have lots of kindling, if you have lots of biomechanical issues, it is much easier to start the fire. However, kindling is all the dry wood and maybe the newspaper you've got around. However, to keep the fire going, we need to add fuel. The fuel here I'm equating to the nervous system, the habits, beliefs, the thoughts, the sensitization in your nervous system. That's the fuel. To keep the fire going, to have persistent pain, we need to keep adding logs to the fire. To also keep the fire going, we need oxygen. I'm going to equate oxygen to your immune system. If we keep fanning the flames, if we keep adding in oxygen, if we keep have an immune system that's not working well and is getting into habitual protective inflammatory reflexes, this is also necessary and sufficient to create an ongoing persistent fire. So the wood is equivalent to the nervous system and oxygen is the immune system. The nervous and immune systems are needed to keep the pain going. Persistent pain is always involves nervous and immune systems being out of overactive in protective reflexes beyond the kindling, the initial biomechanical experience. So the biomechanics is not irrelevant. I'm not saying that, but in persistent pain, it is rarely the dominant contributor. Some people say it drops to 20%, some people say it's 0%, but most researchers offer that the majority of the experience is due to sensitization in our nervous and immune systems. And those I'm going to offer is all about feeling safe, is our goal strategy here. Feeling safe turns off stress responses, turns down the alarm signals, can turn down and reboot your immune system to come out of its protective habits. Okay, couple more slides. We've got 10 minutes. So what are the common beliefs around pain? I'm a broken machine and I'm permanently damaged. These two metaphors really don't serve us when we're working in persistent pain. If you believe that you're a machine, that you're an old rackety machine, you're a machine that's out of line, and that you aren't working properly, then that's going to predict you getting stuck in pain. And if you believe that the damage is permanent, my pelvic floor is permanently damaged after I gave birth, therefore that's a contributor to my pelvic pain, these metaphors don't help people. I want you to think about the Paralympians. Those people really demonstrate the incredible adaptability of human beings. People are jumping higher on one leg than I can on two legs. People are swimming faster than I can with amputations. Human beings are incredibly adaptable. I want us to think about us as beautiful gardens that we can nurture and grow. We can plant seeds of new beliefs, new ways of moving, and focus on our adaptability rather than the concept that we're broken machines that are permanently damaged. That's the essence of all my work. Let's really celebrate what you can do. And actually, we're going to load your tissues. We're going to help you move more to develop your resilience and build your capacity. There's so many ways of moving, so many, you know, if moving your arm in this plane is difficult, let's practice moving it in different planes. Let's give you ordinary tasks of challenge you and loading your tissues to turn down the alarm system, build the tissue capacity, take away the fear of moving. Focus on your adaptability rather than this notion that you're permanently damaged. Here's an example of someone who did this. This is Joella Bolton. She's a really wonderful blogger and pain educator. She was a fire person in America, you know, really robust, embodied person, did a lot of exercise and had a big sort of dynamic job. So really embodied in many ways. And she had a persistent pain experience for 7 years. And she was stuck in the biomechanical model. And her journey to deconstruct that and learn to frame things differently, she articulates it very beautifully. But this is a really simple quote, I think, that summarizes some of the things we're looking for. I still have the same thunks, clicks, weird stiffness in my right hip that makes it feel different than my left, but it's no longer painful. I wonder if it's because the thunking, stiff weirdness doesn't worry me now. I don't think of it as something wrong. It's just something. She's changed her perception. Her alarm system, she's trained her alarm system to not get worried, to make catastrophic predictions when she has a thunk in her hip. It's just a thunk. It doesn't mean she's old. It doesn't mean she's broken. It doesn't mean to say her ligaments are too lax. It doesn't mean to say she's out of line. It's just a little quirk inside of her body. And she can move, be strong, and adapt to that feeling. And in that journey to adapt, she was able to come out of her persistent pain experience. It wasn't an easy journey for her, but letting go of the structure as the primary determinant and appreciating her sensitivity and her ability to manage and respond differently to her feelings was a very powerful part of that journey. Let's take a quick pause here. One slide to summarize, or a couple of slides to summarize, but just see if there's any headline comments here, Julian.
Sure. Samar says, this is also aligned with Dr. John Sarno's approach, releasing trapped emotions. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. Again, I don't want to separate emotions as different from people. So Sarno was a very influential author. He was around, I think, maybe earlier, slightly earlier than Gordon Waddell, The Back Pain Revolution. And he really got some of the complexity, John Sarno. However, I worry sometimes that because we can change emotions, because it's one element of our psychology to change, that you see many authors and alternative medicine practices saying it's all about the emotion. It doesn't follow that changing, because we can change emotion and pain changes, it doesn't follow that it's just about the emotion. And unfortunately, you get a lot of, I would offer disembodied models out there that are focused on spiritual journeys and emotional reframing as the only things that are important to changing pain. So your body is a fiction and it's a product of energy and awareness is a quote from Deepak Chowdhury. And the model often in some of these categories is to change the vibration, change your emotion, change your belief systems as a route to changing pain. But they go quite far and say it's only about the emotion or only about this sort of extended consciousness model. I'm saying it involves those things, but I'm not, you just kind of, we're privileging one element if we're saying it's all emotions in a way that I don't think is valid. It's a biopsychosocial model. It's always multifactorial. There's always many things involved. We can never just reduce pain to emotion, though that is often a very powerful thing to engage with as part of your healing journey.
So there's two questions, Steve, that you might get to in the course or be able to touch upon at the end after your summary. But Tanya here says, so changing the scripts, thoughts, beliefs, etc. is key to changing pain perception. How do we do this? So I guess you'll have more time for that on the course, but you, and I'll read another question that's similar, which was from much earlier on today, which was, how do you normally communicate this great knowledge, a new paradigm with clients? So they're kind of linked, aren't they?
In helping. We'll explore some of how to talk about pain in one of the, in the last lecture series on this one. But first off, I'd say one of the biggest journeys to make is to hear someone's story and be careful of imposing your beliefs around pain on this person. So always the best thing to ask, tell me the story of your back, tell me the story of your neck. And really, that's an awesome question to ask someone if you're a clinician or even a friend. You really need to dig in and be open to say, wow, there could be all sorts of things in this package. So yeah, start engaging at the level of this event has meaning for this. Yes, my shoulder hurts and it's painful, but maybe the biggest consequence of that is I can't play tennis every weekend. And tennis was the thing I used to look forward to. It used to help me de-stress. And those factors that I'm not doing this thing I value, my lived body, my experience of being in the world, my power relationship to the world has changed. And maybe the stress of that and acknowledging that is the biggest contribution to the ongoing alarm system. So yeah, we'll look at some ideas about how to talk about pain, but there are metaphor designers. I love this. There are people who spend their whole life, working life, designing metaphors to help people understand things better. That's often to try and sell things. I'm very happy to be the notion that we're trying to sell this model of pain, to sell that it's more complex than you might thought of, but also that complexity means that there's more that we can do to change the pain experience. But it's not easy, and there are many attempts to do that, and we'll give you some lists of words that don't seem to help, models that seem to focus on, but really my starting line is anything that helps people feel safe, anything that focuses on adaptability, that encourage people to move, and it isn't about mechanical structures that are permanently damaged. Those tend to be useful predictors from the literature. But it's hard explaining pain and it's hard finding the right metaphors for people. No two ways about that. So I'm just going to very quickly sum up, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
So principles to change pain. Education. So this basic understanding, pain is a protective feeling, not an accurate readout of the tissues. I hope I've sort of opened the door to that model for you today. One of the big things is learning to move. We call it graded exposure, sort of slowly doing the thing that you find difficult a little bit, but not too much. So play with movement. So that thing that's painful, play with it rather than force yourself to do it. Focus on your adaptability. Keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. Movement is a massive predictor of people being healthy and happy. Learn to feel. Nuanced, refined, detailed body awareness. This is the idea of being in tune and embodied. Really helps us turn off pain signals. So keep feeling, keep feeling, keep feeling. Finding new words, new concepts to apply to this sensation inside of me. Remember Joella Bolton. There's a funk and a weird stiffness, but I don't get bothered by it anymore. I've learned that it isn't an accurate predictor of me being damaged. And the big headline is safety. Anything that helps you feel safe will turn down the pain. Work to resolve stress and trauma, and looking at larger things in your life that help, that we know, societal dynamics, experiences at work, experiences in your family that make you feel unsafe, that's going to predict you being in more pain, and they help you resolve your pain. Look at the larger things, how we sleep, our general resources are all really important. Okay, well, this was an introduction to this whole pain paradigm and pain revolution. I hope it made sense. The next three are over the next, each Monday for the next 3 weeks. What is pain? We'll go more into the definitions and look at some more detail around that. Number two, we'll look much more at inflammation and how nerves work and kind of the microanatomy of pain, what happens there. And then the third one is much more this debate. How do we talk about pain to our clients and our friends? And how do we acknowledge our own pain? How do we talk about pain to ourselves? Great.
Wonderful. Thank you, Steve. That was really interesting. And it spurred a lot of comments. Sorry that we couldn't answer all of them. There's some great questions there that I hope you'll bring to Steve on the course, perhaps. Did you want to take one or two more, or how are you doing?
I'm very happy to stay around for a few minutes, if that's okay with you guys. I'm no rush.
Okay. Well, one's a statement that the, I don't know if it's a man or a woman by the name, it's not an English name, but I wish I knew all this 20 years ago. After years of pain, diagnosed with various conditions and medication, I was not ready to live in pain. So changing so much in my life, covered here, they changed so much in their life, and now they live pain-free. So that
complexity. What a wonderful story. Yeah. So you really found your adaptability and strategies for yourself. Long journey by the sounds of it. But yeah, let's really celebrate. Humans, you know, basically we're very, very adaptable. If we can focus on that, we're much more resilient than we realize.
And there's two comments about how this is interesting to perhaps postulate the reasons why pain in women might be higher. One lady put, perhaps women tend to tend to keep biting on a problem where men can distract themselves elsewhere. So this is some, perhaps, and Stacey's dropped a link here. Life is often harsher experience for women. The global statistics of women experience sexual assault and violence seem to suggest this. And there's a link there, which I will put if people are interested to look at that. It's from a participant today, so I have not checked it, but I'll share it in the chat for those of you that are in Zoom. And then here we have, what is your take on extending the biopsychosocial to a biopsychosocial spiritual perspective in relation to pain, a perspective which acknowledges that we are embodied minds in relationship not just with each other but with that which is more than us too?
Yeah, that's a big question. In the biopsychosocial model, I think they include faith in the notion of psychology. Absolutely, I think our relationship to spirit is a fundamental question for human beings. And finding safety in a higher power or purpose or meaning in life, this is a, you know, existential journey, a defining journey for many human beings. So finding safety in meaning and purpose and a larger notion of consciousness is very important for many people. My goal is to help people explore that and kind of understand some of the consequences of some of the belief systems I might hold. I will say that typically Christian religion isn't great on bodies sometimes. So the notion of your eternal soul is the thing to nourish, and that bodies are transitory and shouldn't be trusted. They're a bit messy, a bit a bit dirty and a bit sort of primitive. And unfortunately, people think we should punish our body as a way to get closer to God. And, you know, that's a defining image of Christianity, of Christ suffering for us. So there can still be complex relationships to suffering and pain in religion. I'll talk a little bit that on the definitions of pain and what is suffering and how different religions construct suffering and why is that interesting to understand at certain times in our experience.
Cool. Laura on Facebook is saying, I'd like to offer a response to why more women are diagnosed. Whilst embodiment and attunement are important, women also experience higher levels of powerlessness in the external world. You did say something similar, Steve.
I would absolutely agree. So Me Too, with the experience of economic power, sexual abuse, all of those are deeply relevant to the pain experience for women.
Definitely. It is useful to hear pain being discussed as a systemic issue and highlighting the importance of narrative in its experience. Where would I look for more information on pain experience rates, etc., in non-dualistic cultures, please?
The Joanna Burke book is very good. So this is a nice book for just the history and is she good on the culture? I'm not entirely sure. I can't remember if there's a cultural element, but that's a good start. Narrative. She's particularly very good on narrative. Brilliant. Okay, I'm going to stop my screen share. Maybe one more question, and then are we okay to tidy up?
Yeah, definitely. There are some questions and comments that have disappeared on Facebook because Facebook likes to do that. It kind of presents the ones at the top and can be difficult to uncover those. So please bring them to next week's course if you have some that have not been answered. And I'll just look here in the chat. So someone making a comment about the safety model. The problem with the safety model is that it's perceiving safety is a privilege. Some don't ever get to that. There is an assumption that if we work hard at therapy, we will get there. Some just won't.
I agree. There, you know, the notion of privilege has been really amplified recently around race and privilege. And, you know, my initial work, I used to work with people with mental health problems in a kind of poor London borough. And the notion that they could choose to be healthy was really, really problematic. So living in a tower block, being forced to take medication and living on benefits and having no resources, no friends, family around them. The notion that that person had choice about how their life was, I really learned that in my 20s. And I think you're right. The notion of one-to-one therapy is a deeply middle-class event, actually, most of the time. So that ability to assume that I can be safe and I have the luxury of being able to afford one-to-one sessions is really important to acknowledge. I don't have good answers here, but hopefully education can spread out. Hopefully people can find some form of community, and hopefully some of the messages and the ability for human beings to flourish, even in really difficult circumstances, can somehow be promoted. But I don't claim it's easy.
Definitely. We had a webinar with Kalu Lima on inclusivity and diversity, and she's quite inspiring how she takes her work to not under the guise of therapy or workshops, but she takes her work on building unity, agency, consent and things right all around the world into communities and just starts playing music and basically does impromptu workshops. So there are inspired individuals that take the work out of the one-to-one privileged high hourly rate stuff and give it. I think if we have that opportunity to you know, when people are receiving the work and engaging with it and sharing it in communities, those kind of stories are awesome.
Yeah, my contribution is I educate. I like the idea of spreading information. As an activist or campaigner, that's not my primary skill, but I do like giving out information. And I, you know, the information can set us free is partly my hope. I'm not entirely convinced, but it's a start.
Yeah. You can, her name's Kalu Lima. I'll put a link on Facebook. People are asking about that. Yeah, she does what she calls a gentle pushback on the system. So holding hands with strangers in Central Park in New York some years ago and challenging assumptions and stuff. It's really good. I'll put it on the Facebook. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. That was fun. I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, thanks for all your engagement, everyone. You've been great. And you can register for Steve's course on the link in this post or in the event. Find it on Facebook or on embodiedhealthlearning.com. Go to courses. It's called the Pain Revolution. Thank you all. Thank you, Steve. And see you this time next week.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.